to Studio Tulsa, I'm Rich Fisher. In Melanie Gilman's new graphic novel, As the Crow Flies, the main character, Charlie Lamont, is 13 years old, queer, black, and questioning her once firm beliefs in God. So she's spending her summer at an all-white Christian feminist youth backpacking camp. That's the setup for Gilman's work, which started out as a webcomic some 5 years ago. Melanie Gilman is a queer, non-binary cartoonist and illustrator specializing in LGBTQ comics for young adult readers. As a person who identifies as non-binary gender, Gilman uses gender-neutral pronouns such as they and theirs. Their work has been published by Boom Studios, Iron Circus Comics, Lion Forge Comics, as well as Slate and Vice. Their first graphic novel was Smitten, about lesbians, swing dancing, fancy hats, and vampires. As the Crow Flies has received numerous awards as a webcomic, including a Society of Illustrators Gold Medal, and has now been compiled into a graphic novel, the first volume of which is out now. Gilman is a new resident in Tulsa as a member of the Tulsa Artist Fellowship Literary Fellows for 2017, and they join me as my guest today here on Studio Tulsa. Melanie Gilman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the first volume of As the Crow Flies.
Oh, thank you.
How did As the Crow Flies begin?
I grew up as a closeted queer person in a very conservative, suburban Christian environment. I got packed off to Christian youth camps myself every single summer growing up. So I had a lot of interesting experiences, to use a gentle term, as a queer child growing up in spaces which are often not very welcoming to queer youth. And once I got older, I realized that probably many people have experiences like this, and I think that you could tell a good story about this. And I didn't want to do a strictly autobiographical story, partly because I feel like my own experiences were too scattered over too many years. It wouldn't make sense to try to condense them all into one big memoir. So I went a fiction route instead and developed a fictional story which was drawing a lot of inspiration from experiences that I had had over childhood, and which I believe that probably lots of other people have and can relate to in this book.
And of course, you're telling it as a web comic, or mm-hmm. I use the term web comic, a graphic novel, really. Mm-hmm. And it really started out as a web comic, right?
It did. I started it when I was in a graduate program at the Center for Cartoon Studies, which is a comics-only MFA program out in rural Vermont. It was part of my senior thesis back then, and back then, nobody really knew who I was, because, you know, you're just some 22-year-old grad student living in the middle of Vermont. And I really didn't think at that time that there was going to be any sort of traditional publishing market for a book like this, which is, I mean, it's kind of a weird book. It's what many publishers would consider a niche topic, talking about the experiences of 12 and 13-year-old queer and trans children in a Christian youth backpacking camp. So I went the webcomic route because I figured the web is free. I don't have to deal with any publishing gatekeepers. And also, this is a way to get the book out into the world where it's very easily accessible, particularly to young children, the kind of people who are about the same age as the characters,
having some of these experiences.
Yeah, who
right?
might be going through some of the same things and might enjoy the book in that sense. And I have gotten a lot of feedback from young readers in particular that most of them are actually reading it right now through the webcomic version. And one of the strengths of the webcomic version is that you can read it and, A, you don't have to spend $30 on an expensive graphic novel, which a lot of kids can't afford. And, B, if you are in a school or a family or an environment where you might not be able to safely have a graphic novel in your collection that deals with LGBT themes, it's much easier to be able to find this media online and be able to read it safely without coming under scrutiny or getting in trouble or having to out yourself to your parents or to teachers who might not be accepting of this.
Right. And you know, a lot of times at that age, you're not really sure where you're at.
Yeah,
a
lot of kids are still questioning at that age.
So what was the reaction to the webcomic?
Mostly positive. Most people were really pleased with it. I mean, many of them were a little sad that I could only update so quickly because I'm very slow doing everything in colored pencil. But Honestly, it's been great. I've reached a lot of people this way. My audience is very wide, like not just young children, but also a lot of older readers, too. I've got people who are in their 50s, their 60s, who will write me about the book, and it's wonderful getting to see their reactions, too. And just getting that feedback and the feeling of connecting with your audience directly, there's a lot of strengths of being able to put work out online because it's so easy, it's so accessible, it's free, and you can really get it into the hands of readers who will be interested in it.
So this first volume, how many years of work is this? Is it a couple of years, 2 or 3 years?
It's about 5 years. I think
5 years. Wow.
Yeah, I think I started this in 2012 and finally turned in the finished pages around sometime this year, 2017. So just about 5 years.
And in fact, where the web comic now, this story is continuing. It's going to be a second volume at some point. And you're still writing the story at this, or at least
Yes. Illustrating
and writing the story at this point, right?
Yes, I'll probably be still working on this for another 4 or 5 years after this. The second volume will probably be about the same length, so somewhere in the 250 to 300 page range. And it'll still be all colored pencil, and I'm working on it to this day.
Now, colored pencil is such an exacting media. And I know a lot of cartoonists will use ink. A lot of them are using markers now for color. Why choose the colored pencil route?
On some level, it just felt right to me. Colored pencil is a very precise and nitpicky and kind of a personality medium. So if you really like getting detailed, if you really like working in color, and you really like having a lot of control over what the illustrations look like, colored pencil is a really great medium for that. It also has a kind of a warm and organic quality to it that really felt right for a story like this, which is it's both outdoors, so the scenery, the environment is a really important part of this. And it's also, it has an intimate feeling to it and a natural feeling, which I really enjoyed and which is very an enjoyable process to draw. I have a great job, honestly. I get to put on podcasts, put on audiobooks, like sit myself down in my studio and just color trees for hours on end. That's a pretty good life right there.
You know, when you look at the art, in many ways, it's an amalgam of what I'd say is almost like retro illustration techniques. I'm thinking post-war. Has that been a big influence for you?
It has, actually. I appreciate that you noticed that. One of the jobs that I have been doing as kind of a side job to help support my comics habit is I teach college-level classes. And one of the classes that I taught for many years when I was out of grad school was an illustration history course. So I was looking at a lot of the old classic children's books from, you know, the 50s, 60s, even people like Raymond Briggs, who did books like The Snowman. And he's often not credited as being a cartoonist, but a lot of his books were actually comics when you look at them. They're presented in children's book format, but they have panels, they have sequential narrative to them. They have all the same tricks and tools that comics use. And he was working entirely in colored pencil for many of those books. So people like him were definitely an inspiration when I was thinking about how I wanted to make this book visually feel.
And it does have that look, but when you're doing your landscapes, it has a completely different look. It doesn't look like the 50s or 60s. I guess your characters sort of have that look mm-hmm. to me, and I guess that's just sort of your own way, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, every cartoonist develops their own unique personal style over the course of drawing their books. I mean, it kind of feels personal to each artist in the way that handwriting feels personal. Like, everybody has a little bit of their own visual signatures that go into the way that they draw, and I think comics are no different. And there's also, a lot of times in comics, it's kind of a thing that a lot of people do where you have very detailed and more realistically rendered backgrounds, and then the characters themselves tend to be a little bit more abstracted, a little bit more cartoony. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of them is that just cartoony characters are more fun to draw, and you can make them be more expressive. And it also has to do with relatability. Scott McCloud has a theory that he put forth in Understanding Comics, which is the kind of the seminal academic text on understanding comics theory, where he talks about the way that when you distill images, particularly human figures, down to their essential forms, their essential elements, they become more relatable to a wider audience of people. And comics really takes advantage of that because you can up the cartooniness of what you're drawing and have it be more relatable to more people. And I think in a book like this, that becomes really important because particularly when you're talking about the experiences of queer people, a lot of times we are not considered relatable to mainstream audiences. Our stories are considered niche. They're considered marginal. They're considered like a very, you know, a very tiny, tiny subset of stories and relatability. So being able to use the language of comics to tell a story that is something that can touch more people, that's one of the wonderful strengths of the comics medium and one of the reasons why I love working in comics, particularly for telling queer YA stories.
My guest today is Melanie Gilman. She's a graphic artist, cartoonist, and Tulsa Artist Fellowship literary artist, the artist and maker of As the Crow Flies, a web comic graphic novel. It's a story of queer and transgender teenagers, two teenagers who meet on a Christian feminist youth camp backpacking trip. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, in telling this story, your main character, Charlie, is a person of color. Why did you make that decision?
There were several reasons. Some of it was just that as I was thinking about this book and thinking about these characters, it just felt right in a way that Charlie be a young black girl who's attending this camp. I mean, sometimes characters tell you things about themselves when you're writing them, which is a really interesting process. It was also that I knew that going into this, many of my memories of growing up in these Christian camps were just how white they were and how overwhelmingly blind to that fact they were. And I didn't want that to be just a footnote in this story. I wanted to make sure that that was something that was addressed directly. So it made sense to make Charlie be a black girl and talk about the experiences that you would have not only dealing with issues of homophobia and transphobia in these spaces, but the other kinds of blind spots that white feminism tends to have, and especially when it's put into religious spaces, because modern Christianity in the U.S. is still very segregated as far as religions go, and I didn't want that to be just a side note in this story. I wanted to make sure that this is something that we talked about directly. And again, on top of all that, you know, it also just felt right in some, you know, spooky, intuitive author sense. As I was developing this character, this is how she presented herself to me. And I tried to do justice to that on the page.
And really, what's interesting about this summer camp or this youth camp is that it seems to be a progressive feminist Christian youth camp, and yet they fall prone to all this language. Very early in the book, Charlie is hearing them talk about, I think it was at the whitening of the soul, mm-hmm. and she's going, what did she just say? So you're getting into the language of white privilege as well as this feminist thought, which is very exclusionary and to a lot of other people in our society.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of this book is presented essentially as talking about the ways that white feminism is failing a lot of people and a lot of youth especially who don't fit into this very narrow white, straight, cisgender, able-bodied sphere. If you deviate outside of that, if you are a person who's not able to fit into all of those privileged axes, then a lot of times the supposedly progressive language that white feminism uses actually excludes or actively harms you. So yeah, when I was creating the cast for this book, I was deliberately coming up with ways that I could have children placed into this environment who, in their own particularly, would be able to challenge this. And some of that has happened in Volume 1. There's going to be even more of that that's happening in Volume 2.
I think that's the case, yeah, from what I could tell from Volume 1. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You're leading up to a lot of things happening.
Yes.
But in the meantime, Charlie meets Sydney, who at first is annoying to her, and then they find that they both have secrets as far as for the rest of the campers, and Sydney is transgendered, mm-hmm. and they find that they have this kindred spirit.
Absolutely. Because For those two characters in particular, even though on the surface it doesn't seem like they have a lot in common, they have very different personalities. Charlie is more introspective and a little bit shy and not very aggressive about, you know, standing up for herself, still has some confidence issues, things like that. And Sydney is kind of the polar opposite of that. She's very outspoken, very loud, unafraid to call people on things that they're saying or doing, and has a very weird sense of humor, and is very energetic. So these two are kind of opposites in a lot of ways, but they find common ground in that both of them, for some different reasons and some of the same reasons, are being excluded by this dialogue that the camp is having about their supposed feminist roots, feminist values, and it's all going to come to a head with this ceremony, which seems poised to be potentially dangerous for both of them. Charlie for being a black girl, Sydney for being a trans girl, and trans women and trans girls are very, very, very frequently excluded from mainstream feminist discussions because many mainstream trans exclusionary radical feminists don't want to acknowledge the womanhood of trans women. And that is a major problem for many trans girls growing up in spaces like these. So these two characters, even though they have very different personalities, they're able to come together and find a community with each other. And a lot of the book is about how they are able to use their friendship as a way to keep each other safe and to challenge this system together.
Now, you're very open that this book is inspired by some of your own experiences. Did you ever experience a feminist Christian summer camp that involves a week-long backpacking trip to the top of a mountain where you're going to go through a, quote, purification rite?
Not quite. The feminist agenda of this Christian camp might be the biggest fiction that I'm telling in this whole story. The Christian camps that I was sent to as a kid very, very often would not label themselves as feminist.
Right.
Even the ones that were all-girls camp, because all-girl Christian youth camps are very common, and a lot of them have on the surface kind of a girl power agenda, but they don't follow through and make that empowerment accessible to all the girls who might be there in that camp. But I will say that I was growing up in Colorado, so a lot of the scenery is based off of my memories
right.
of the Rocky Mountains. There are actually a lot of very strange little Christian shrines, like hidden deep up in the woods. Some of them are modern, some of them date back years, but you can sometimes stumble across these strange little shrines that people have erected. So I took that idea and said, okay, what if we make that kind of the climactic element of this story, that we're going to go find one of these historical shrines at the top of a mountain, and we're going to recreate a Christian women's empowerment ceremony that would have happened in the 1800s, and which is very much so based in 1800s white feminism, which is just as scary as it sounds.
It is scary. And you know, and I think towards the end of the first volume, they're explaining the story and somebody pipes up and says, so when all the women left town, how did the men get by? And they said, well, there were others. And mm-hmm. Charlie Mines goes, oh, slaves, ex-slaves, people of color, people down the socioeconomic pecking order did this work. And it's like this unspoken sort of exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Again, getting into this idea of exclusionary language.
Yeah. And the way that white feminism often builds its own, like, you know, women's empowerment narratives, specifically by ignoring the way that racism played a role in allowing white women to access that level of power, or those women's communities which were dependent on the exploited labor of women of color, and obviously which were extremely exclusionary to queer women and trans women. That is a theme that this book wants to tackle directly, is the way that so much of white feminist history is written without acknowledging the ways in which white feminism was also targeting many women and was exploiting the labor of many women.
My guest today is Melanie Gilman. She is a Tulsa Artist Fellowship literary artist and a graphic novelist and cartoonist. Her latest project is titled As the Crow Flies. It's the first volume of a two-volume, what originally started out as a webcomics, now a graphic novel, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, as you said, this has some autobiographical roots. One of the things that I loved about this was how easily I took Charlie, this main character, into my heart, and as far as just being such a wonderfully sympathetic character. She holds this secret in this summer camp. I was wondering what that experience was like for you in your own. Were you questioning at that particular point? Were you consider yourself non-binary queer today? Mm-hmm. Were you sort of your identity settled at that particular point or what?
Very much so not.
Yeah, right.
I was growing up in a community where queerness and trans identity was something that people simply did not talk about. So you can imagine the experience of being a child and having feelings which you can't explain and which you don't have any frame of reference for, but which on some intuitive level you understand are dangerous and will get you in trouble, get you ostracized, get you like even to the level of being kicked out of your family. That's something that happens to a lot of queer and trans youth to this day, is being disowned, being homeless, being physically assaulted. These are all dangers that can happen to young people who are going through these exact circumstances. And there's an added level on top of that, I think, for a lot of transgender and non-binary children in particular, and I'm a non-binary person, so I use the pronouns they, them,
uh-huh.
And you know, you can imagine growing up as a child in the 90s how you would experience these things and be so confused about your own gender and the fact that everyone's gendering you in a particular way, but you don't even know what the words are to describe that, and you know that you couldn't explain that to any of the adults around you. So it becomes a very, very isolating and traumatic experience for a lot of children. And I think that Charlie and Sydney have some advantages on that level, because I do think that things are starting to change a little bit for LGBT youth across the nation. A lot of that is because of the internet, because there are more resources and more information available to both children and their families who are growing up. I hope that me, being a person in their late 20s, I'm one of the last generations of queer youth who grew up without access to those same resources. So I hope that young children today aren't going through quite as isolating of a time, even though they still have many issues that they're going through. But the chances of them being able to find community with other children, with other people who are in their environments, in their communities, in their schools and classrooms, I'm hoping is more likely. I'm hoping that there's more likelihood that they're going to be able to find friends like Charlie and Sydney around them. And in many ways, that's what As the Crow Flies is about. It's about children putting out those tendrils and trying to figure out who else they can talk to about this and who they can open up to and how they can protect their own friends and their own communities.
And boy, that's just got to be the toughest decision on whether you open up to somebody as you're getting to know them,
mm-hmm.
and probably even knowing them well. It's still a very tough decision.
Absolutely. Especially in a high pressure situation like a week-long camp where, you know, you can only get to know these other kids for a couple days at most, and then you got to make a snap decision about, do I trust this person? Do I not trust this person? And you're in the middle of the woods somewhere. So if something happened, what would you do to protect yourself? What's your safety net when you're in the middle of nowhere and probably don't even have cell phone service?
Right. Again, you're working on volume two. What's the timeline for having? I know you just got this one finished, but you've actually been advancing the story through your webcomic, mm-hmm. right?
Yes, and the webcomic is going to keep updating right up to the end of this story. So before volume two even comes out, anyone who wants to can read along for free online. And I'm very happy that the publisher was willing to let me do that. A lot of publishers are still a little hesitant to let people give away their books for free before they try to sell them a print edition. But in this case, it worked out wonderfully. So yeah, I'm guessing that volume two is probably not going to be finished for a few more years, probably another 3 or 4 years.
And you've also been telling the backstory of Sydney too as well, right?
Yes. For volume one, we did a Kickstarter campaign to raise funds to print the first print run of the book. And that was through Iron Circus Comics, who's the publisher. And we raised enough money that we actually had a stretch goal that we hit, where I agreed to draw a 24-page side story comic about Sydney and her mom, which is kind of a prequel to As the Crow Flies. It's set a couple weeks before she starts camp, and talks about how her mom, who is a low-income single woman, trying to raise a 12-year-old trans daughter in the middle of a kind of conservative Christian community, the struggles and the sacrifices that she makes in order to keep her daughter safe and try to give her the best possible life with very limited means.
One of the things I did like about the parents, you only meet Sydney's mother through this add-on, but we only meet Charlie's parents at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be open and accepting, although I'm not sure why they sent them. This Christian camp.
Yeah, they did at least give her the option to leave the camp right at the beginning. Yeah. And that's, you know, that can be kind of similar to what many queer children experience is, you know, like, why did my parents send me here? What were they thinking? But it keeps
happening.
Even
well-meaning parents.
Yes,
yeah,
yes. Right. And Charlie's parents are absolutely well-meaning, which is part of why, as soon as they saw that this is a very white space, they immediately gave her the option of, we can leave right now, no questions asked.
Have you heard from, like, families who have said, you know, this has helped us have conversations about this?
I have, actually. I've heard from a lot of families, a lot of young people, a lot of parents also, and a lot of teachers and librarians, too. A lot of people have responded very positively to this book, and have found ways to get it into the hands of young people, both LGBT and not. And I have also heard a few reports of young people trying to, you know, subtly slide it across the table to their parents, just like, hey, mom and dad, you might be interested in a book like this. So I really value that. I think that that's one of the important things about queer middle grade and YA books in general, is that they're accessible, they're enjoyable. Comics are kind of fun to read almost no matter what the subject matter is. There's something for everybody in there. So I'm hopeful that with a book like this, it can be a connection point between young people and their families, between different generations of people, and can help them start dialogues together.
Well, it's an important story, and it's beautifully illustrated too. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
Melanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tulsa Artist Fellowship Literary Fellow, cartoonist and illustrator Melanie Gilman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The new graphic novel is titled As the Crow Flies, and it's published by Iron Circus Comics. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.